Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. We dip into the tax-deductible music archives for Christina Aguilera. This song is called Ceasefire. Christina Aguilera's Ceasefire is in a war of romance. And yesterday, between the time I finished recording my News and Comment podcast and just the few minutes it takes to put it up on the internet for you to listen to, the news broke that Egypt had announced that it had brokered a ceasefire. And as I followed the news cycle into the evening, we saw Israel embrace that. But Hamas was apparently not consulted. Neither was Islamic Jihad, the other warring faction in Gaza. And so what appeared to be a unilateral suspension of its grisly assault on Gaza lasted for as long as 6 hours. And then when rocket fire from Gaza resumed, Israel resumed its aerial assault on the Gaza Strip. And once again, this is being seized for propaganda opportunities by the Israelis. They're now blaming Hamas for failing to pick up on this ceasefire opportunity. And it becomes the pretext, the excuse for Israel to pound the Gaza Strip even more relentlessly. And today, the corporate media in the U.S. is abuzz because a single Israeli has been killed. And I regret the loss of all life. But when you look at the attention given to the first Israeli killed versus as many as 200 Palestinians, largely women and children, well, the disproportionality of the coverage, the way Israel is given a pass, allowed to call it self-defense when it unleashes an offensive on Hamas. And so it goes. And this conflict appears to be one that will not be resolved quickly. I was frankly surprised, even that Egypt had floated a ceasefire yesterday, and skeptical that it might hold. And, you know, I have to acknowledge that I do not find Hamas to be an attractive organization. Many of their policies are extreme reactions to the long-term brutality of the Israeli subjugation. But often the actions of Hamas are not helpful in defusing the situation. And one can say, well, you know, it builds up. When you are treated like animals and caged in an open-air strip of land, it can change your thinking. There's no doubt about that. So here's a quote from Netanyahu. We agreed to the Egyptian proposal in order to give the opportunity to deal with demilitarization of the strip from missiles, rockets, and tunnels through diplomatic means. But if Hamas does not accept a ceasefire proposal as it looks now, Israel will have all the international legitimacy in order to achieve the desired quiet. So I wasn't a party to any of these discussions, but I look with a jaundiced eye. And it's a legitimate question. Did the Egyptian military dictatorship, which largely supports Israel, and is no friend of Hamas, did it participate in this cynical public relations game? And now we can tag Hamas as the party that wouldn't come along with this plan to restore peace. Well, Islamic Jihad said in a statement that the Egyptian proposal did not meet the needs of our people and the conditions of the resistance, which was not consulted. A Hamas leader, Musa Abu Marzouk, based in Cairo, said on Twitter, around the time the rockets were flying, that the organization was still consulting and had not issued an official position on the Egyptian initiative. And so this is a he said, she said, finger-pointing exchange. But once again, the world and the United States in particular allow Israel to play fast and loose with facts and with the origins of this conflict. And last night on television, in an interesting break, and let me be fair, I don't watch MSNBC every hour, every day. And I typically watch Rachel Maddow's program. She's on vacation this week, so I watched Chris Hayes. His show's called All In. He opened up with a segment about the conflict of Israel attacking Gaza. And it was relatively fair for an American network. And to his credit, Hayes interviewed a correspondent who's on the ground in Gaza. And while mild criticisms of Israel were inferred, there was no challenge to the now myth that the three teenagers who were killed, the three Israeli teenagers who were kidnapped and killed, were dead for 18 days before the Israeli government announced it, and during that time, they drummed up a hysterical response, a vengeful atmosphere. And now three Israelis who killed a Palestinian teenager have been charged. But it remains to be seen what kind of trial they'll receive and what kind of punishment, if any. And it's very interesting, as you may know, last week we conducted a very important and exclusive interview with journalist Max Blumenthal. As I've mentioned, his book last year called Goliath is quite revealing about life in Israel. And because I think it's so important, and because I haven't found any other American media outlet except Max Blumenthal's, the website where he publishes at the Islamic Electronic Intifada, and a story in the Jewish newspaper Forward, our podcast is only the third media account of the way Israel has manipulated the story of the three kidnapped teenagers to trump up this opportunity to pound Hamas. So a friend of mine who works at Facebook gave me some Facebook ad credit. And so we have posted the Max Blumenthal interview to people who ordinarily don't see any information about my podcasts. And on Facebook, you got friends and you got strangers, right? Well, here are posts from four people who I do not know, and I will call them strangers. And it's fascinating to me to see how comfortable they are in their ignorance. A woman named Andrea Grenadier responded to the Blumenthal post about the way Netanyahu manipulated the story of the three teens, and wrote just a few words. Seriously? Blumenthal? No. Now, she doesn't explain why she's biased against Max Blumenthal. And it's clear, or at least I can clearly infer, that she didn't listen to the podcast in question. The next post is from Paul James Durfee, who likewise is proud and ignorant in equal measure. He wrote, "Who gives a shit?" And then in all caps, "I stand with Israel." Then we have Scott Rose. "Why is this stupid, hateful crap showing up in my Facebook feed?" So something that questions the corporate media narrative is stupid, hateful crap. Okay. And then the final one from Simcha Saul. And referring to Blumenthal, he says, how does he know what are the facts? Does he have insight into Hamas motives and plans? I think he is pulling stuff out of the air. Well, likewise, I have to assume that Simcha Saul has not gone any further than the little bit of information on the Facebook post before drawing his conclusions about Max Blumenthal's reporting. And I challenge anyone who finds this hard to believe. Maybe you think it's hateful crap. Maybe you don't give a shit. You just want to stand with Israel. Well, I challenge you to listen to the full interview with Max Blumenthal before you come to those kinds of conclusions. Every day we pause to thank the people who subscribe and support my work here at peterbcollins.com, like Anna Gordonier, a monthly subscriber. Faith Peoples, yeah, we mentioned her yesterday, but Faith has two separate subscriptions to support my work. That's generous. Then there's Gunnar Gunderson, Carl Hesterberg. Thank you one and all for your support, and I'd like other people who are like-minded to join you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the link under my picture. It'll take you to the page that lets you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. The best deals are $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers in the U.S. get bonus gifts, including the CD called Red Flag by John Dist, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Well, as the conflict in Gaza rages on, the areas of American occupation and former occupation are likewise on fire and blood is flowing. In Afghanistan, a huge blast from a sport utility vehicle packed with explosives in a small town in eastern Paktika province created one of the deadliest terror attacks in Afghanistan since we invaded. 89 people at least were killed, and at least 40 others were injured. The body count may climb. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the sectarian bloodletting continues, Sunni on Shia, and 12 bloated bodies were found in the Tigris River on Monday, east of the town of Dululia. And this is the town that, in short order, was taken over by the Sunni extremists, so-called ISIS, on Sunday. They barreled into the town just 45 miles north of Baghdad, seized the mayor's office, police station, local council, courthouse, blew up a bridge, and then 12 bodies were found in the river. Many Iraqis, this is reminiscent of the bloodletting that occurred back in 2006, 2007, which was interrupted by the so-called surge, which, of course, was just a PR game. We paid Sunnis not to kill us and Shiites. We separated the two different religious ethnic groups. And the inclusion of more American troops was really incidental to the short-term reduction in violence that occurred. In Britain, an official from the government was carrying some documents last week, and a media photographer managed to get such a sharp, focused picture of it that they could determine that the documents were logs which reflect America's arrangements with Britain and the secret prison that we have kept or did keep. It's not clear if we've ever closed it, in the Indian Ocean island of Diego Garcia. Diego Garcia, more accurately an atoll, is a possession of the United Kingdom. But the U.S. has a lease on a military facility there. And the documents being carried by the government official in Britain were marked sensitive, confirming that the logs recording details of planes landing and taking off are being handed off to detectives who are investigating. how much cooperation the British government gave to the United States in its illegal torture taxi program, the so-called rendition program. And, of course, we have to rely on these kinds of disclosures coming from Britain because the Obama administration has effectively sealed the information that was once public. And this is one of those Kafkaesque moments. In 2009, shortly after Obama had been sworn in, the case came before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco, related to a man named Binyam Muhammad who was renditioned and sent to another country for torture. And the lawyers in their discovery had, from public documents, figured out that the company that was hired, it was a company called Jeppesen Aviation, and it is or was a part of Boeing. And Jeppesen had the contract with the CIA to run corporate jets to ferry these kidnapped suspects to the darkest sites in the world. The Obama administration adopted the same obstruction policy of the Bush administration, saying that this could not be tried because state secrets are involved. Only they were trying to declare secret things that were already in the public domain. The judges were shocked by it and asked the lawyers if they were sure they were arguing for the right administration. Maybe someday we'll get full disclosure on these illegal actions that were conducted by our government. And here is a stunning development, because the District of Columbia Court of Appeals is one of the most powerful benches in this country. And for the last 3 or 4 years, they have been routinely turning down any appeals coming from Guantanamo prisoners with far-fetched explanations of, well, the government must know something, or, you know, we defer to the executive branch. Well, they overturned 2 of 3 counts in the conviction of a prisoner whose name is Bahlul. Bahlul was arrested in Pakistan in December 2001. He's been in our custody for 12 years. He was convicted on 3 counts and sentenced to life. But now 2 of those 3 counts have been knocked out by the appeals court, saying that his conviction for solicitation of others to commit war crimes and providing material support for terrorism were laws that were not on the books when he was taken into American custody. It ruled that the solicitation charge is plainly not an offense traditionally triable by military commission. And the material support was knocked out by a court ruling in the past. I think it was the Razul or Hamdan decision, I'm not sure exactly. One of the judges wrote, "The government offers little domestic precedent to support the notion that material support, or a sufficiently analogous offense, has historically been triable by a military commission." And the opinion makes clear for the first time that material support and conspiracy could not be applied if the alleged violations took place before the passage of the 2006 law, the one that I call the Joe Stalin Detention and Trial Act, I think is what I called it. So he now is innocent of 2 of the 3 charges. Presumably he will be resentenced, and possibly the life sentence may be revoked. Secretary of State John Kerry has been all over the damn place recently. In Vienna yesterday, he said that tangible progress had been made in negotiations on Iran's nuclear program, but real gaps remain. And he was flying back to Washington, he said. Or will he go to Cairo? He can't quite make up his mind. The quote, "I am returning to Washington to consult with President Obama and leaders in Congress about the prospects for a comprehensive agreement with Iran, as well as a path forward if we don't achieve one by the 20th of July, including the question whether or not more time is warranted." What a windbag that guy is. He can never say something in, you know, 5 or 6 words. So I remain hopeful that these talks will produce a breakthrough. But as so many things, time will tell. Now to the mess on our southern border, populated by thousands of immigrant children. Today, in a shameful move, the Obama administration deported a group of Honduran children. Actually, it took place yesterday and is reported today. Some of them as young as 18 months old. A charter flight from New Mexico to San Pedro Sula, Honduras, the city with the highest murder rate in the world, returned 17 Honduran women, 12 girls, 9 boys. And this, of course, is intended to send a signal. And I do understand the difficult choices available to the Obama administration. Because as long as people leave Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador and don't come back, the assumption will be that they're in the United States and they're going to find a way to stay there. But the idea that we're just putting these people on a plane and sending them back, not knowing if they've been personally threatened by a gang member, if they've lost a family member to a gang murder. I mean, these are not idle threats. These are not speculative or hypothetical conditions. And so smug Americans might say, well, it serves them right. But we can't return all 52,000 of those estimated to have crossed the border already. More are on the way. And I do support efforts to try to get the Mexican government to limit the entry of these transients on their own southern border before they even get to the United States. And the president of Honduras, Juan Hernandez, in an interview published on Monday, blamed U.S. drug policy for sparking violence and ramping up migration to the U.S. Now, that is part of the problem, but it's not everything. And just as we are irrationally unwilling to end our failed war on some drugs, these governments in these troubled countries aren't doing much to get control of their own domestic situation and violent gangs and other criminal groups. So there's no easy solution here. That doesn't stop a couple of members of Congress from Texas, Senator Cornyn and Congressman Cuellar, who's a Democrat, from proposing an amendment to the 2008 law that requires that the child immigrants who don't come from Mexico or Canada be put through a process by Department of Health and Human Services that takes months and often leaves them with foster parents or relatives here in the United States. And I don't think that is a real solution either. But it appears to be the price Obama will have to pay in order to get the funds that he wants to deal with this refugee crisis. And I've never seen Americans so mean-spirited, so cold-hearted, so willing to shun these young people and just say, I don't care if they die, get them out of my face. Many of these are the same extremely religious, or at least they advertise religiosity. They claim to, you know, have a mandate from God to make government smaller and kill some immigrants, and it's just so incoherent. And yet, the media in this country allows a lot of incoherent ranting to get broadcast and published on a daily basis. I don't know what you think of José Antonio Vargas. My feelings about him are a little mixed. He's an undocumented Filipino immigrant and a journalist. And he's written a book. He formed an organization. And he has put himself on the line subject to deportation because he has been so public as an undocumented non-citizen. And so on Tuesday, he was detained at a Border Patrol checkpoint in way south Texas near McAllen. He was handcuffed, taken for processing. Now, Vargas is traveling on a Filipino passport, but it doesn't have a current visa. And so his status in the country is, well, he's subject to deportation. He says he didn't know that he was in a zone where he was going to have to go back through a border crossing, and that he travels by air frequently and uses the Filipino passport, and they don't check his immigration status. They just check the passport. Vargas quoted as saying, "I didn't even think twice about it," when he accepted the invitation to join a news conference near McAllen. When he realized he was effectively trapped, he said, "No, this can't be for real." So we'll see what happens with Senor Vargas. The Internal Revenue Service has caved, cratered. I'm really embarrassed to see this. As you know, for over a year, the Republicans have been hammering the IRS because its office in Cincinnati, which has the job of evaluating applications for new nonprofits, had put aside some conservative groups, and it turned out some liberal groups, purely political organizations applying for a nonprofit status so that they could hide the source of political donors. That's the only reason for these political nonprofits. The Republicans act as if they're entitled to nonprofit status just by filing an application. And anyone who has formed a legitimate nonprofit knows that it takes up to 18 months for that office in Cincinnati to grant your nonprofit tax status. But these political groups decided that this was something that was intentional on the part of the Obama administration, that they had been targeted. And I think it's false, and I think the Obama team did a lousy job of refuting the false arguments that came from Republicans. And now they're going to seal this case shut, and the Republicans will always be able to say that Obama targeted conservative groups using the IRS. Isn't that evil? So on Sunday, the commissioner, John Koskinen, told Time magazine that 80% of charitable groups seeking tax exemption will go through a simplified application process. Those that report assets under $250,000 and income of less than $50,000 a year can pay a $400 fee, fill out a 3-page form, and automatically be eligible to receive tax-deductible donations. Now, that is streamlining for the legitimate nonprofit groups that I don't have a problem with. But this will also give the expectation to political groups that if they can form with those lower numbers, at least at the filing stage, they can always add more money immediately after they get the grant. Well, this is a huge, huge loophole. A back door that has been opened. And we're going to see the proliferation of phony political groups posing as nonprofits so that they can hide the source of the dark money that they're getting. I thought it was really cool yesterday on television. I saw the footage of the Italian cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, which of course hit the rocks and capsized. It was laying on its side just a few months ago, off the west coast of Italy, near Tuscany. And I don't know if you've seen it, but look it up on the internets. It is very cool the way they attach these big steel bladders to the side of the ship, pump those full of air. The ship righted, and then the ship has started to become afloat. They're going to haul it off the rocks into deeper water, float it even more, and then take it to a scrapyard in Genova. And finally, here in California, you may have heard that there's a billionaire from Silicon Valley named Tim Draper who has been promoting a ballot measure for this November's election. And it is expected that he will announce today that he bought enough signatures to put it on the ballot. The proposal is to split California into not two or three states, not even four or five states, but six states. And I actually think it's a good idea to split California. But six is way too many. I think two would be manageable, three might be ideal. And of course, you know that, for example, the 34 or 35 million people in California only have two senators, but the million people in Idaho or Montana, respectively, also have two senators. Now, we get more members of Congress, but that's not helping the left these days. And the real issue is, can six states drawn out of the current California be economically viable? And I think the answer to that is a resounding no. Particularly the state of Jefferson proposed for the northern reaches of California and the desert areas connected to San Diego of South California. Just not enough people, not enough revenue to keep the roads paved. And so I think this will lead to an interesting conversation. I'm disappointed that Draper insisted on six because I don't think that we're going to get an honest reaction to this. Most people are just going to say, oh, that's crazy. And I believe it's just an advisory measure anyway. It doesn't actually cause the splitting of the state into subdivisions. And, of course, the real power remains with Congress, not to mention the existing state legislature in Sacramento. Both would have to approve the division of California and accept the new states into the union. And I don't think any of that is about to happen, even in the distant future. So we're going to go through an exercise, and there'll be some media coverage about it, and that'll probably be healthy. But in the end, I think after the November election, we'll still have one golden state of California. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until